O thou great and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. And may we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Thursday the 20th of September 2018, Order of Proceedings. Confirmation of minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 18th, 23rd, 30th, 31st of May, 1st, 15th of June, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 24th of July 2019. Communications from the chair, petition, announcement. Do you want to go between things, sir?
Mr. Speaker, at Lena Day, I ask you, Mr. Speaker, by your leave, I'm going to make a statement on the progress of ongoing Brexit negotiations in respect of Gibraltar's departure from membership of the European Union alongside the United Kingdom. Because honourable members will already know, the Deputy Chief Minister has convened a further informal meeting of the Brexit Select Committee of this House for tomorrow. This will be the 12th such meeting, resulting in at least as many hours of confidential briefing. At these meetings, honourable members have been briefed in careful detail about the ongoing dispute contact that the government has had in the context of these negotiations. These contacts include discussions with Spain in its capacity as one of the remaining 27 member states of the European Union. Mr. Speaker, I've just announced on the 28th of March of this year, 1 year before the date when our departure from the European Union will be legally effective. So we're going to set out as much detail as I could then of what the EU discussions are likely to entail. I told the community then that we were entirely confident that the withdrawal agreement must and will fully apply to Gibraltar. I am even more confident now, Mr. Speaker, that that will be the case. That means that any mechanism agreed between the United Kingdom and the European Union for orderly withdrawal and continued market access will fully cover Gibraltar, and that we will enjoy continued access to the EU single market until at least the end of the transition period. The work that the Prime Minister is doing in Salzburg today will, I sincerely hope, also move the United Kingdom and the EU closer to such arrangements. And in that context, we have also sought, Mr. Speaker, to establish new lines of cooperation with the EU and, in particular, with the neighbouring member state, Spain. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the successive government of Gibraltar has sought such a relationship before. And we have done so without the need for any compulsion or threat of veto. We have done so because the people of Gibraltar have consistently sought good neighbourly relations, and we have consistently sought to demonstrate our belief in the European ideal. That has always been our nature. And that is the work that we have been trying to discreetly do. The Partido Popular administration of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy took two distinct approaches to the Brexit negotiations. The first approach was spearheaded of José Manuel García Margallo, and at his time as foreign minister after the result of the EU referendum. He stated that the position then of the Partido Popular government in Spain was that the government would have to accept the joint sovereignty proposals we had rejected in 2002 to be wanted a future relationship with the European Union. When he was replaced by Alfonso Vázquez, the position of the Partido Popular, set out by the new minister and by Prime Minister Raúl himself, was that Spain would not be seeking to advance its sovereignty claims in the context of the Brexit negotiations for the withdrawal agreement. Indeed, in my statement in March, I said that our people would have heard, and I quote, Mr. Speaker, the repeated statements in Spanish ministers setting out that sovereignty is not a matter they are seeking to raise in Brexit discussions. I said also that I knew we would all welcome that, although we would be sceptical and alert to ensure that that remains the position throughout. We thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm also pleased to be able to tell the House that the position of the Portugal administration of Pedro Sanchez has not changed in respect of the issue of sovereignty. That is to say, the position of the Spanish government has not changed in respect of in relation to the negotiation of the Brexit withdrawal agreement. All of the members will therefore have been surprised to see some Partido Popular politicians in the past 48 hours suggesting that it has been a historic decision not to attempt to progress the sterile Spanish sovereignty claim. The fact is, Mr. Speaker, that there has been no attempt to advance the sterile claim either under the Partido Popular or the Popular in the context of the exit discussion. If that had been, everyone knows what the answer from us, on behalf of the whole South and Gibraltar as a whole, would have been. And it would have been firm, clear, and absolutely negative. We have to be careful, of course, to ensure that the ingredients of sovereignty, including jurisdiction and control, have also been clearly understood not to be negotiable. And in that carefully circumscribed context, we have advanced in respect of those areas denominated as irritants by some. As I said at the time of my statement in March, we have considered matters related to the unlawful suspension of Gibraltar Airport and the European Civil Aviation Rules, despite the Cordoba Agreement of 2006, in the sector of, and the £84 million airport that members of the state have been. We've also considered other matters of lower political profile. These include, firstly, our removal from unfairly compiled and maintained Spanish tax haven blacklist, and better cooperation between our tax authorities, as we have been proposing for years under the successive Gibraltar government administration. Such a traffic flow at the frontier. Cooperation on police and customs matters, including curbing cross-frontier smuggling in both directions, and how best to ensure that we discourage illicit trade in specific items subject to excise and special duties. And better environmental cooperation, especially in relation to air quality and the protection of the environment in the region of Gibraltar and the territory made up of the municipalities of the Mancomunidad and municipios of the Campo de Gibraltar as a whole. I also said in March that I was unable to say more about the structuring detail of the discussions we are engaged in. I said that I was unable to do so without endangering the real opportunities for progress that we had identified and not out of a desire not to be totally open with our community, although we would, of course, be fully briefing cabinet ministers and elected opposition members. So, Mr. Speaker, I do not feel that the time is yet right for me to be able to say more. But I also wish to the House and to the nation. Every time that the term bilateral talks between the United Kingdom and Spain in relation to Gibraltar is wrongly attributed, both the United Kingdom and Gibraltar government have repeated that such a description of the discrete discussions about ongoing is not accurate. Both governments have repeated that there was no such separate bilateral process in relation to Gibraltar between the United Kingdom and Spain. And although I will not say more, I know that everyone in this community will have heard the statement from the former Prime Minister of Spain, Mr. Rajoy, about discussions with Gibraltar at the end of the European Council meeting in the spring. A transcript of his remarks, published in various national and international media, and in fact, there was a video of his remarks, Mr. Speaker, reads as follows. The conversations with Gibraltar will not deal with the issue of sovereignty. It is one thing is Brexit, and another is that we remain in our position, as could not be otherwise, and as everyone understands, he said when asked if they have now left the issue of sovereignty totally to
be recorded in Hampshire for posterity or indeed to figure perpetuity, which may be a more appropriate way. Additionally, this week, the current Spanish Foreign Minister, Josep Borrell, has spoken candidly about these dispute discussions in a breakfast forum in Madrid. His remarks have been widely reported. A transcript of his remarks, published in various national and international media, reads as follows. The EU is negotiating through Mr. Barnier the conditions of the UK's withdrawal and has stated that in order for the withdrawal agreement to be applied to Gibraltar, this must be through a bilateral agreement between Spain and Gibraltar that we are negotiating. Even though Mr. Barnier is not part of that negotiation, he is following it closely and he knows that without any agreement on this, there will be no agreement on Brexit. As the Brexit negotiator, he's the first one to be interested in us reaching an agreement. That's what we're working on, and I think we can be optimistic, and I believe we are very close to a solution for the withdrawal agreement. What we're negotiating is not the return of the Gibraltar to Spanish sovereignty, or the sharing of that sovereignty, but the conditions under which the withdrawal agreement can be applied to the territory of Gibraltar on very specific issues. The President of the Government of Spain told Mr. Barnier yesterday that Spain's goal is that the agreement with Gibraltar should not be the last obstacle in the road, but rather the first step towards the withdrawal agreement. In other words, that we should not get to the end and be in agreement on everything except Gibraltar, but that the agreement on Gibraltar should be the first step towards the final Brexit agreement. Again, Mr. Speaker, I think it is important that those words should be recorded in Hansard. Mr. Speaker, there are substantive discussions, and it's fair to say that we are not dissatisfied with progress. There is a long road still to go. But as the Spanish Prime Minister is reported to have told the EU's chief negotiator, we do hope that matters related to Gibraltar might be the first element of the withdrawal agreement and the future arrangement to be agreed in a positive spirit of cooperation between the UK and the EU and between Gibraltar and the member states that is our closest neighbour, Spain. And that means that we would likely be finalising a differentiated deal for the rest of the United Kingdom as we leave full membership of the European Union. The Speaker thankful that that would not be possible. Indeed, some thought that we would be wrong to pursue such a solution. Yet today, some 26 months on, I'm able to tell you confidently that the need for such a differentiated solution has been understood as much in London as it has in Brussels and in Madrid. Today, I am optimistic that we will soon not hear more of sterile vetoes when it comes to Gibraltar and our future relationship with the EU. I sincerely believe that we will be able to talk about a future for Gibraltar which provides not just for a continued enduring political relationship with Britain, but also a continued enduring political relationship with Europe. Considerable work has been done by the team I assembled in the immediate aftermath of the referendum to seek to secure the realistically deliverable opportunities that arise in the context of Brexit. There is no deal to announce yet. There is not yet any definitive text beyond the withdrawal agreement to support over that can be published. But there is an element of goodwill. There is an understanding of what no deal can mean for the whole of the council that he has had also. And I believe that we have designed to see a future relationship which provides certainty to residents of Gibraltar and to citizens of the Union. Certainty in protecting established rights, certainty in frontier liberty, and certainty in our continued relationship with Britain. But, Mr. Speaker, as ever when it comes to international treaties in relation to Gibraltar, or indeed anything else, the devil is in the details. And we will remain entirely vigilant that there should not be any attempt to try to advance in areas of sovereignty or other unacceptable aspects of what might eventually be agreed, or the form in which it might be agreed. That would never be acceptable to any government of Gibraltar or to the Parliament. So we will continue to seek a future in which Gibraltar will continue to have a relationship with the European Union that will deliver prosperity not just for us, but for all the country around us also. Already, we have seen our commercial access to the United Kingdom market secured. We have seen health, education, and gaming, and financial services access secured as a result of the work that we've done with the UK government. Now we hope to be able to say more in coming weeks of what else we have been able to secure for the future. Mr. Speaker, it is important that I should record the thanks of the government for the work that is being done by the government's Brexit team. In particular, I must record the thanks of the Deputy Chief Minister and myself to the Attorney General, whose EU expertise is unrivaled and has been a huge asset to the nation at the time.
the financial secretary explain also some of the work that has been undertaken. And alongside them, and many other members of our public sector have been called upon to assist us in the preparations and progress of these discussions in the different relevant areas. I also want to thank members opposite, Mr. Speaker, who make up the Brexit Select Committee, having respected the confidentiality of the, and integrity of the briefing of today, and for their constructive comments in this House about the work that the government is doing, in particular, Mr. Keaton and Mr. Van Lamp. Finally, Mr. Speaker, it is expected that the final arrangements between the UK and the EU will be finalised in coming weeks. At most, over the period of 8 weeks is now the limit for reaching a potential Brexit General Affairs Council of the European Union in mid-November. We will be involved in continuing discussions and meetings of variable geometry between now and then. We will therefore not be able to hold monthly meetings of the House in that period. At this same time, we will also be attending the annual political conferences of the political parties in the UK, as well as the meeting of the Fourth Committee of the General Assembly of the United Nations. And throughout this period, we will be at what one might call peak Brexit. Those who are addicted to the 24-hour news cycle should be ready for many ups and downs and many peaks and troughs, and indeed, Mr. Speaker, a little bit of drama. I want to keep in our minds that this process is a negotiation that has been visited upon us all, not by any action or desire on our part, but by the decision of the British people that the peak of Brexit is that we should leave the European Union. Today, Mr. Speaker, as a result of the question, I will move into bills. And it will be necessary for me to take a number of bills on the order paper, some of them, if possible, before the end of September. The House will then resume for consideration of bills, and after that, we'll then resume again for questions as soon as possible. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
In keeping with established practice, I am going to say that statement is made. Honourable members of the opposition, my last question for clarification purposes. And my last question, they are not entitled under the rules to make a political statement, but I invite them to ask questions to clarify anything in the Chief Minister's statement that they wish to know more about.
We have a Brexit meeting tomorrow, so therefore any questions that I have in relation to this, you can ask tomorrow after considering many in detail the statement of the Honourable Chief Minister has made. I did want to make a few words, say a few words on behalf of the opposition with Mr. Speaker's guidance, if that is at all possible. If not, I will sit down. I won't label a statement.
No, so you said a few words to come to a political statement, and that is, I say, honourable members of the opposition are not entitled to do. Honourable members of the opposition are entitled to make personal statements, but the rules do not allow for them to make a statement of the nature which the Chief Minister has made. Nevertheless, after established practice over the years, they are able to ask questions for clarification, and clearly, it is within the wherewithal of honourable members to place questions in such a way that they are getting more clarification from the people and, if necessary, making their views known. That is the practice which they use in any case at question time, so it's not particularly different.
The difficulty with the course of action that Mr. Speaker proposes is, of course, that we have been, as indeed the Chief Minister has recognized in the course of his contribution and the statement that he has had today, being very, very careful not to divulge anything that has been imparted to us on a confidential basis within the context of the Brexit Commission. It is very difficult from this side of the House to divorce ourselves from information that's been imparted to us in that context in devising questions of the Chief Minister on his statement. And therefore, it could lead to us effectively asking questions that faces the Chief Minister in a difficult position, or indeed questions that we would not wish to ask in public. That is the... I was going to say a few words, but Mr. Speaker,
if I understand the Honourable Member more clearly, is what he wishes to do is to make a statement which, broadly speaking, is in support of the government, then I have no problem in allowing that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the opposition, it will. On behalf of the opposition, and I think it is important that we publicly state in this House with our positions and on a statement of importance to the Chief Minister has just made, it is incumbent on me, on behalf of my colleagues, to offer the government Godspeed in relation to, wish the government Godspeed in relation to its endeavour in reaching the best possible agreement with the Dalton. Ultimately, we are public servants working for the people, and no public servant would do otherwise. We're also either business owners, or employees, or tax children that take advantage of our education system, that we all need the GHA, and all of those are all dependent in one form or another on the government successfully being able to navigate within a minefield and successfully come back with an agreement for the good. I will also say this, Mr. Speaker, that if there is a difference, having said that, there is a difference between this side of the House and that side of the House, I have recognized it, that on many occasions that the government has kept the opposition fully brief in relation to the discussions that have taken place between the government and the United Kingdom, and indeed also, I recognize, having been subject to the statement that the Honourable Chief Minister has made, and indeed, it aims its discussions directly with Spain. I've never said that publicly, but of course, now that it's been said in this House by the Honourable Chief Minister, I recognize that we have indeed in relation to those. The difference, Mr. Speaker, and I don't wish to make this in any way, shape, or form political or subject to the political party structure one has in relation to other issues, is that, of course, we would have, as we've been in government, fully involved in the opposition of the day in the process, in those negotiations and in those discussions, as has happened in the past, in particular, between the OECD government and the opposition. But Mr. Speaker, and therefore, in that context, we will continue to keep a very close eye on development, and by necessity, we need to reserve our position of an opposition, having not participated in those discussions, in what emerges ultimately from this particular process, and of course, as colleagues at that point. I will say this, and I've been asked by the leader of the party to make these comments, which are opposite in my respective view, and it's this. First of all, any talk that are taking place has got to be structurally sound. And by that, I mean that bilateralism between the United Kingdom and Spain is out of the question. And in that context, I have heard what the Honourable Chief Minister says, and of course, on this side of the House, it is, of course, music to our ears on this side of the House. It is right, and the government is absolutely right to engage with Spain directly in relation to these issues. What the UK is negotiating with the EU may well be opposite to the UK, but may not be opposite in respect of the border. And it is right that the government should engage directly with Spain in order to attempt to reach the best possible solution and deal for Gibraltar. Of course, always bearing in mind, and again, I do not doubt the Chief Minister's words and the assurances to this House, and I welcome them, that in that context, there is no question of either sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control being on the line in any of the discussions that the Chief Minister has had, or his officials have had, with Spanish officials. Mr. Speaker, lastly, I also want to say this. It is certainly true from briefings that we have received, and I mentioned this because, again, the Chief Minister has accepted in the course of his intervention, that both Rebecca and Rebecca before were approaching this from the point of view of party sovereignty, party jurisdiction, and control, and concentrating effectively on issues that are of mutual benefit to both Spain and also the world. So I wish to make a point that I have made always when I have gone to Spain and I have given speeches in Spain or lectures at universities, which I've done on many occasions. That to do otherwise and to pursue its sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control concession, which will never ever be acceptable, either to the government of Gibraltar or to the opposition, here in Gibraltar, is effectively to condemn the process to no agreement at all, because no Gibraltarian is ever going to agree to those types of concessions. And all it does, Mr. Speaker, is effectively push Gibraltar, ultimately it will be, is push Gibraltar towards seeking greater political links with the United Kingdom, and that is not a strange answer. And Mr. Speaker, with that, I end my contribution, and I wish to thank Mr. Speaker for his indulgence in allowing me to say radio.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank the Chief Minister for his statement, and for my part, in this little corner of the House, I want to thank the government for all the hard work that they are putting into the Brexit negotiations and say unequivocally that I recognise that this government has a mandate to manage Brexit, and they are doing the best job that they possibly can, and right now is not the time for political point scoring, divisions, and trying to get one over on anyone. We are all in this together. If there comes a time to nitpick on the government's performance on Brexit, the time will come, but I think right now we all need to focus our energies together, try and be constructive and support the government for a future which we all want to work out for every single one of us. Thank you.
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Thank you for the opportunity to reply to those points. I don't know that the right to respond to a statement under the rules is any different whether one thing is what used to happen over all the years, during the 20 years when I was a member, in fact, they were not allowed to reply, except on some occasions when it was a matter of, so to say, foreign affairs. Then the then speakers were somewhat more liberal. But without going as far as they do in the House of Commons, I think it is beneficial to members and to the voters generally that where statements such as that made by the Honourable Daniel Peterson have opportunities to begin, which also gives the Chief Minister an opportunity to further elaborate.
I don't think that the Honourable Gentleman has made a statement which is lacking in controversy, and therefore, unfortunately, I think that we may have strayed into territory that may not necessarily be in the best interest of the group. But I will try and deal with the points made in a way that is as circumspect as possible. But I would commend, Mr. Speaker, a rule as to how and when statements are applied to should be followed for the purposes of ensuring that we don't err in the way that we might have today. Mr. Speaker, I have not said that we are engaging directly in contact with Spain in the way that I think the Honourable Gentleman has interpreted. I have said that we are being discreet about the type of contact that we are having, but I have repeated and read into hand
for the historical record, the words of the former president of the Spanish government and the words of the current Spanish foreign minister, so that nobody will be able to point to the chief minister of Gibraltar as having indicated what the nature of the discussions being held has been. And that's very important, because if one is loyal and faithful to a process that one enters into, and one has said that they're going to be discreet for a reason, and others are not discreet, then it is important that it is the lack of discretion of others that is reflected. And I think it's an important point. Third, the government has then said, by looking into controversy, by saying that if they were the government, they would have fully involved the opposition, as it would have not, Mr. Speaker, in the negotiations. Like, he says, the AACR North America.
The only single member of the AACR. Under the discussions on the Brussels Agreement, the AACR did not involve the opposition at all. The AACR only involved the opposition prior to Brussels, at the time when they were appearing as petitioners in the United Kingdom, and on one occasion, in 1981, when Mr. Francis King was foreign secretary, I myself accompanied Mr. Gessler with the late Peter Isola, and Mr. Peter Isola was present at the talk with Francis King. Subsequent to that, there was no occasion between them and when we left government, when the AACR involved the opposition in anything to do with Brussels.
That is exactly the point, Mr. Speaker, and I'm grateful for. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, it is particularly important that when honourable members make points as to what they would do, we must judge them not against what others do, but against what they did. So if all they were to say, we would have done if we were in government what the AACR did, and Mr. Speaker, my recollection of the historical record that you put out at that time is exactly as you provided. But honourable members were in government in 2002 when the joint sovereignty issue came. And honourable members were in government in 2005 and 2006, and subsequently, when the trilateral forum was engaged and the Gondwana agreement was produced, and they did not involve the opposition. So for honourable members to say we would have done what others did, but not to reflect on what they actually did, the last time that there was an opportunity for engagement, I think, Mr. Speaker, grows into controversy. Because I'm sorry to say to them that it is not believable, Mr. Speaker, that they would have acted now in a way that is different to the way that they acted in 2005 and 2006 and 2002 and 2003. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I know that there were many voices urging the then administration to involve the GSLP opposition in the discussions and all of that about what emerged was not a GSB deal, it was a Gibraltar deal. And the similar sentiment was expressed on the French side that the historic would involve a deal of a development to extent they did, but then there was a rejection of that by the other side. It's bigger than this. The other gentleman cannot, in my view, get up and say something which can go into that level of controversy without expecting me to reply. Mr. Speaker, finally, I was surprised in the context of what we were discussing today that he should explicitly say that he was going to act as a ventriloquist for the leader of the party who is not present in the House, Mr. Speaker. We have heard that there may be judgment on what we do once it emerges. Well, Mr. Speaker, that's probably the biggest non-statement in history. Once something is done, we'll see whether it is rightly done. Of course, that is when we will judge when it is rightly done. And I think it must be structurally sound. So, Mr. Speaker, I just said in the House, for the purpose of the Hansard, that we are satisfied that things are structurally sound. And I think honourable members know enough about what is was going on in the context of the confidentiality or the reasons that they had to know that things are structurally sound. And that we are always bearing in mind it is a federal jurisdiction for control. I spoke specifically today, Mr. Speaker. And the other issue that I was surprised to hear the Honourable Gentleman raise was in fact a repetition of the position that I took out on behalf of the government and the whole Parliament. The judiciary would never engage in a dialogue, in a process, or in a discussion, let alone a negotiation, which sought to engage sovereignty certificate, or indeed the ingredients of sovereignty, sovereignty jurisdiction, or control. But Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to come to this House to advise Spain what's in her interest in us. I'll leave that to others. I do recognize, Mr. Speaker, that I've gone into the controversial aspect of what the Honourable Gentleman said. He said them, so I feel politically I have to deal with them. I also want to thank him for the things he has said, other than those points I've taken, which are supportive of the position of the government. And I think the Honourable Lady's expression of it, I think, was as eloquent as his when he started, which is that we are, in effect, all of us in this together. And in the same way as Lord Denning said that European law has flowed into the rivers and tributaries of English law, the consequences of Brexit will flow into the rivers, tributaries, and veins of everything that we do as a community and everything that the United Kingdom does as a nation after the 29th of March, and as a result of the arrangements that are entered into for withdrawal of any such arrangements are entered into life, until they are likely to be entered into. So this is going to affect everything, whether it's the health service, who can work in the health service, who is able to trade from Gibraltar, what they're able to trade in, and how they are able to trade. And every aspect of our lives will be affected, whichever side of the house we sit on, whatever political ideology we pursue. And so I thank honourable members opposite for those parts of their intervention that recognise that, and those parts of their intervention that uncontroversially support the work that's been done by the government.
On
the annual report of the Gibraltar Police Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2018.
Order to report the committee, answer to all questions. We commence with question number 446 of 2019, the Honourable Tian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, with reference to questions 77 and 78 of 2016, and in respect of the investigation conducted by the Port Authority, has the government made the conclusions of that report public? And if so, can the government advise where they can be found?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Speaker, I can confirm that an investigation into the disembarkation of a 60 member from the MV Capitan Basilis on 10th January 2016 was carried out by the Gibraltar Police Authority. It appears that the findings of that investigation were not made public at the time, despite the comments made by the Chief Minister and Mr. Argyle. The Parliament announced questions 77 and 78 of 2016. This was, as I understand it, an oversight. I can, however, Mr. Speaker, confirm that the findings of the investigation were that there were failures to follow established protocols relating to the disembarkation of 60 members by the duty force officer, the vessel's local agent, the contracted launch service, and the port medical officer. The report concluded that the disembarkation in breach of established protocols occurred because the Gibraltar Port Authority were not provided with all the relevant facts concerning the 60 members, and the duty force officer did not question the vessel following a medical declaration of health which stated that there was a 60 member on board. Following the investigation, the following actions were taken by the Gibraltar Port Authority. One, a letter was sent to the vessel's local agent, advising them that the GPA considered
considered that their failure to follow the required protocols was a breach of the terms of their license, and that the GPA was mandated to suspend their license for 2 weeks. The agents were invited to submit representations to the GPA. Following the receipt of those representations, the penalty that the GPA proposed was itself suspended. Two owners were sent to the operator of the service launch, which evacuated the crew member from the vessel, stating that the GPA had identified they were stolen by the operator, which the GPA considered amounted to a breach of the terms of their license. The letter stated that the GPA was minded to suspend their license for 7 days. They were invited to submit representations to the GPA, and following the receipt of those representations, the penalty which the GPA proposed was itself suspended. Three, the port medical officer was asked to attend a meeting with the captain of the port in order to assess what lessons could be learned for the future. Four, a verbal warning was given to the duty port officer, which was to remain in his personal file for a period of 3 months, and the officer required to receive remedial training for the relevant procedure and protocol. Five, a fourth circular was sent by the captain of the port to all shipping agents and operators which stated, I quote, "Following a recent incident, I wish to reinforce the importance of the need to alert the GPA as soon as you become aware of a medical case, whether it requires medical attention or not, on board a ship bound for diversion. This includes all vessels expected to enter BGTW and those conducting OCL transfers outside of BGTW. In particular, I would like to remind all agents operators that it is essential, and that is capitalized, essential that they have GPA approval prior to any patient being disembarked. The GPA, in consultation with the GPA, with the GHA, will advise or arrange for a doctor, paramedic team, or ambulance while they attend on board or at the point of disembarkation as directed by the GPA. The GPA launch, port launch, or service launch will be used for transfer. The doctor or ambulance paramedics will inform the GPA on the condition of the patient before such patient is permitted to be landed at the diversion. This procedure also applies to any crew member who needs to attend a medical clinic. GPA should be notified prior to disembarkation of such crew member." End of quote. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that the results of the investigation and the actions described above were provided to Mr. Isola, who was the Minister for Maritime Services at the time, and Mr. Rajan, who was the then Minister for the Port. Both Mr. Isola and Mr. Rajan were satisfied with the steps taken by the GPA on this matter.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for that comprehensive answer. Just a couple of points for me. As the report has been presented to the Ministers at the time, it would have been possible to have that report shared, if it's still available with the opposition. The Minister, a number of measures were clearly taken subsequent to the incident, which is heartening to see and hear. In terms of lesson learning, the lesson learning that took place after the Minister did refer to a lesson learning session with the captain of the port. Could we clarify what lessons specifically were learned from this incident about the action that we've already described?
If you think of the lessons, I'll start with the last point. The lessons were very simple. There are established protocols which were not followed. There is a very clear procedure in respect of vessels entering BGTW, which refers to a paragraph on medical cases and all the steps that are required to be taken prior to disembarkation of a ship crew member. Those steps, some of those steps were not complied with, and the lesson was quite simply that people needed to be reminded that those steps were required to be taken, that there are responsibilities, firstly of the duty force officer at the GPA, secondly of the agent of the vessel that come into the data, thirdly of any service loan that is used to go out to the boat, and fourthly, from the port medical officer, the lessons and of the duties in respect of each of those items, and the lessons were that the protocols needed to be highlighted, reiterated. They didn't need to be rewritten. They didn't need to be reestablished because they existed already, and they're very clear in their terms. And therefore, the issue was, how is it necessary
to highlight and reinforce the importance of following those protocols, which still exist and would continue to exist in the same form, because there is nothing to change in terms of the protocols or procedures. It is just the fact that those procedures were not carried out in this particular case. As regards the report itself, I was careful in putting out the findings. The report does mention names, and mentions names, but I'm happy if the Honourable Member will speak on a confidential basis of the conclusions of that report. I can let the Honourable Member see that, but I was a little bit averse in making the whole report probably because of the names that are mentioned, but I have been very clear in terms of the findings of the report and the action which were taken as a result of that report.
Clearly, if there are matters in the I fully understand that. If the Minister would share the conclusions of the listener, I would very much appreciate that. Just one point on the established protocols, they're clearly effective if followed. That seems to be one of the conclusions of the report. How are those expected to enact the protocols of the PCA and the entrance? Made aware of those protocols as a part of their training when they as part of the job, or where are those protocols established that they might be able to determine in a future event, maybe something happens 2, 3, 4 years down the line where corporate knowledge is favoured, so we can be assured that everyone is still aware of the protocols, where to find them and how to follow them.
These are of the internal protocols of the procedures of the GPA. They set out very clearly the responsibility primarily of the support officer at the time and the communication that the support officer has to make. My understanding, and I cannot answer directly the question as to whether or where they can be found, but my understanding is that all agencies that operated, all operators that are publicly licensed and have to do with the report, the agencies and service law operators are made aware and that this protocol is disseminated. That is something that I am able to confirm to the Honourable Member. But certainly the protocols are clear and training is given at the GPA level in terms of its own officers as to the need, because the protocol is not just protocol in relation to medical cases. Medical cases is one section of a full protocol which sets out the procedure for dealing with that presenting the territorial waters. So there are various matters that need to be taken into account, including whether there is a medical case, the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that what happened in that particular case, which was essentially a disembarkation of somebody without those procedures being taken and without being clear as to precisely what the 60 members had before being disembarked and before being taken to the site.
And I don't want to labour the point, so would the Minister be happy, perhaps if I write to him asking some specific question on the detail of this, why I've been done and what you don't have the answer to, so it wouldn't be fair to ask you, and the question is maybe the other way, and it's directly from the original question. So if the Minister is happy, I'll write to him just to answer the question in more detail. Thank you.
Question number 447, the Honourable D.A. Peaton on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Is upon the government concerned the frequency of inspections by factory inspectors over the last 12 months at all housing estates in which refurbishment works are being conducted.
I answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Speaker, the frequency by which factory inspectors undertook inspections over the last 12 months at housing estates in which refurbishment works are being conducted are as follows. September 2017, 10. October 2017, 8. December 2017, 6. December. Okay. November 2017, 6. December 2017, 0. January 2018, 5. February 2018, 15. March 2018, 9. April 2018, 5. May 2018-6, June 2018-8, July 2018-9, August 2018-6. Therefore, in that 1 year, that was my period, the total number of inspections at housing estates in which refurbishment works were being conducted was 87. And I would also add, Mr. Speaker, that in the set of that very same 12-month period, the total number of inspections carried out by housing inspectors, including those housing estates, amounted to 671 in just a 12-month period.
If I may ask the Minister, how many taxis and inspectors are there at present?
I believe the answer to that is 3, but I don't need to actually confirm that with you in a minute.
And, Mr. Speaker, have there been any health and safety issues that have arisen as a consequence of these inspections that have been brought to, obviously, to the Ministry of Defence?
Mr. Speaker, that, unless I go through the whole list of what it is they did and inspected and every single item, the question simply related to the frequency statistics. This is a statistical question. I've got the statistical information. I do have a full report, but unless I go through item by item, then that is not within the statistics. But I'm happy for the Honourable Member to raise that with me separately or in writing or in the subsequent meeting with the Honourable Member when. It's just the question of statistical and the information I have provided is and concentrated on the statistical nature of the question.
No doubt, Mr. Phillips will take up the Honourable Minister's kind offer. But may I ask this, that nothing has taken the Minister's, grabbed the Minister's eye, so to speak, in terms of any concerns that have been raised by the factories and sectors, that perhaps the Minister has taken a personal interest in.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that no specific concern in respect of those 87 inspections has been raised with me.
Question number 448, the Honourable D.A. Seaton on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Because you really can't gain a larger issue, you know. Can the government state the rate of unemployment as of the 12th of September 2018?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial, Aviation and the Port.
The Speaker, 95 fast launch license applications have been approved. The average number of devotees registered and employed in the second quarter of 2018 was 45.
Question number 449.
Obviously, those are the people that are registered as unemployed. But this is a separate employment. Does the Minister take an interest in relation to statistics from this point of view? How many people there are that are, for example, on the books of agencies on 0-hour contracts or on very few contracts? And let me just explain the reason why I'm asking you. Because, of course, you may have 45 people that are unemployed, but if you have another 45, that are on 0-hour contract, the reality of the situation is that they may be employed because they're in the books of the agency, but that really they're not in active employment as anybody outside in the street would understand it. Is that something that the Honourable Minister has looked into and taken interest in?
I think not in terms of my own responsibility as Minister for Employment, because what the Honourable Member is suggesting, or what it would essentially entail, is that in respect of all supply workers around the board, in respect of any subcontract that the Honourable Member would have, that I would have to take a personal interest in calling each agency and finding details of each particular employee that is registered with the employment service. From the employment service point of view, which is what I'm asking for, and this is what the question relates to, but clearly it is a collection of statistics, and the answer that has been given is a statistical answer, but a lot of work goes on behind the scenes in terms of the employment clinic, the employment clinic, seeing people, making sure that you match vacancies to the people with the right skills. So a lot of work goes on in order to achieve the social statistics that we ultimately see reflected in the answer that I have just given. So the question is, do I call every single person that registered any kind of contract to find out how many hours each particular person works? The answer is no, I don't do it.
Does the Honourable Minister bear in mind that he is a minister within a socialist government? That the socialist with a socialist and liberal front, that a socialist government. A socialist government should take an interest in how many people out there are on 0 hour contracts or a handful of hours in their contract, which then means that unemployment figures would make a mockery of unemployment figures if there are hundreds of people out there. Because you see, that's a way in which you can mark who unemployment in Gibraltar. Or indeed, at best for the government, it would mask how many people there are in real jobs. Because if you are on a 0 hour contract, you're not in a real job. And I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that I am astounded and intermediate that the Honourable the Minister seems to be able to disregard the question as if it were something that only idiots fall into the tree would ask, which is a question, Mr. Speaker, that no doubt is relevant and pertinent to those people that are languishing in those 0 hour contracts.
It is not relevant to the main question, which is about the number of people who are registered as unemployed. And no doubt when he reached contract, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition would ask a separate question, asking the Minister whether he knows how many people are on 0 hour contract. But you don't have to answer. And certainly, you don't have to defend the extent to which you are a socialist.
Next question, Mr. Speaker. Although it is true that I don't have to answer, and certainly, it is more than true that I don't have to defend the extent to which I have, or my party, as a government, with a liberal, have socialist credentials. The fact is that not only was the question raised and asked, but there was an accusation there of masking these figures and an expression of astonishment and astounding by the Honourable Members, which I don't think can be in equal measure raised. That goes well behind the astonishment and how astounded we were in much greater measure than the Honourable Member has expressed today. When we learned just before the general election of a program that the Honourable Member on BBC appeared with me, that it was the Honourable Member, the DOD, that was in fact masking the relevant unemployment figure. Through the mouth of the Honourable Member who is today asking the question, and who is suggesting that there was nothing involved, that the TSC has been stretching massaging the figures, but finding hundreds and hundreds of unemployed persons. When we came to know how much the future strategy was going to cost for its own assessment of how much it was going to cost, we know that the reality was that there were around 1,000 people unemployed when that figure
May I ask the Minister, in relation to his answer, which is a question specifically about the role of unemployment
a specific date, and he gave the number of 45. From the government website for employment and statistics, it refers to unemployment quarterly as Gibraltarian. They often ask that, is Lee Alton Day just a Gibraltarian, or is that include all people who are entitled to register as unemployed?
The answer I gave specifically refers to the number of Gibraltarians registered unemployed in the second quarter of 2018. Those are the figures that are generally given. Although specifically the question refers to the rate of unemployment as of a particular date, 1st of September, traditionally, all these questions have been asked on the basis of the figures and the statistics that are compiled on a quarterly basis, and therefore always given. I have examples of other questions that have been asked by Mr. Phillips and previously by Mr. Bocina, specifically on this issue. And on all occasions, the answer that I got, the answer is the quarterly average of unemployed Gibraltarian for the last quarter, or for this particular quarter in 2013 or 2014, was X. So we have followed the same format that we have given in the past.
Is it then possible that in fact the number could be higher given that he's only referring to Gibraltarian? I told the Honourable Gentleman what I can do for assistance, Speaker. I see the general figure, not the figure which is broken down into Gibraltarian to others, and the general figure is the same as the figure the Honourable Gentleman has given to Gibraltarian, which is, Speaker, I believe, less than one-sixth of the number of people that the Honourable Gentleman said either in that same program or another, which constitutes full employment for Gibraltarian.
Question number 449, the Honourable D.O. Seaton, on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, given that Mr. Speaker prevented me from having a happy ending, can I say that I don't agree with the way that the Honourable Gentleman would have characterised my performance during the course of that debate? But I proceed to question, can the government state the number of staff lords' licences that have been approved since the 26th of November 2015?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, many staff launch license applications have been approved since 26 September 2015.
Mr. Speaker, when an application is made for a fast launch in Gibraltar, do the authorities consider the purpose of the license, presumably? If you have any information in relation to what the purpose of those applications for licenses for the use of the fast route was to be in relation to these prospective licensees?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. There is a procedure, particularly in those that is governed by statute. It is voted by the Gibraltar Police Authority, and they will have the criteria which they will follow. The purpose, whenever, and I should say, these are not referred to me. These are matters that are voted by the Gibraltar Police Authority. The ones that are referred to me are whether there is an application for an exemption from the fast launch regime. Honourable members may recall that when we made the small boat marina, there was a provision made for an exemption for certain types of vessels from the fast launch regime up to a certain limit, in particular how fast the launch could go, not exceeding 40 knots in particular. But as far as I can see, all of the launches are simply recreational boats.
Question number 450, the Honourable Ellis Yama.
Mr. Speaker, will the government be installing the locally designed two screening fences?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. I want to take this opportunity to sincerely congratulate Mr. Greenberg on behalf of the government for her vision and sensitivity in coming up with this prize-winning design, which the Ministry of Equality helped sponsor. Mrs. Greenberg won the third prize in the Street Seats International Design Challenge. All we did the replacement of this new bench from the station and are installing new street benches. I very much look forward to seeing the benches installed in various appropriate locations to be identified.
Question number 451, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the official opposition, I would like to associate myself with the support for Mr. Matthias Greenberg and congratulate the government in their quest to install the fence in the region. With regard to question 451, can the government provide its churches with a list of complaints raised by the previous tenant at 62/4 Black Basin Road, received by the government up until June 2018, including the date and the nature of the complaints?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the information requests personal data relating to an identifiable individual and is therefore contrary to the GDPR or data protection regulations.
Mr. Speaker, I'll accept that is the advice that you have received with regard to data protection. Nevertheless, I have been to visit this property and this property was handed over to Mr. Gomez 2.5 months ago. I think the Honourable Gentleman did not say into mention a name across the floor of the house. I think it's against the rules that we should do so. And I think you can probably find another way of describing the gentleman. I would just didn't say the tenant, for example, rather than mention a name.
Okay, so I do apologize, Mr. Speaker. It's just because it has been in the public, it's been published in the press locally and we have been in the commission. But in any event, I appreciate that I do take the thing. The tenant, I did go on a visit to the tenant who received this property 2.5 months ago. And there are some serious issues which have not been dealt with, which I am told by the people who live around this property that those problems have been historic and they have not been dealt with. With the Honourable Minister for Housing accompanying us in visiting this property to see for herself what the issues are and whether they're acceptable for somebody who has received this property in this condition.
Mr. Speaker, I think the gentleman is quite remarkable in the approach that he takes, in the sense that perhaps if the Honourable Gentleman wishes to accompany the Honourable Lady in her role as Minister, and with her very full day, stay in the effort as late as she does, do all the things that she needs to do structurally in respect of the housing department, she might then at the end be persuaded that actually for the Minister to go to each one of the properties where there may be a report, which is then dealt with in keeping with the criteria and timing that each report requires, with now no battle of thanks to the work that the Honourable Lady and previous Minister for Housing under the current administration have done, that you might find that picking out from simply the press the one case that has got media attention is not the appropriate way to deal with things. In fact, it would be entirely inappropriate for prioritization of work to be done on the basis of who shouts loudest on social media, who puts it on a newspaper or a broadcaster. And in fact, what the Honourable Gentleman will be doing would be assisting somebody to jump the queue, assisting somebody to reprioritize themselves in a way that is perhaps not appropriate, or indeed, Mr. Speaker, breaking the rule that ministers have actually set policy not to go on the ground to actually be doing the getting rid of the calice and then doing the repainting. That's not the role, Mr. Speaker. I know that he's in the political stable of the man who used to go out to the building site, not to see how it was going, but to redesign the staircases, throw his hat on the ground, and kick the wheels of the Jaguar. We don't do business that way.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister aware of the issues that are related to this property, which are causing the tenant considerable stress, which is regarding historical issues, but as well as part of the repair and the refurbishment of the property has indication, which is not up to standard. For example, one of the things is a south face which is 43 centimeters high. And I appreciate that the ministers are here to set policy, but there are times where ministers have to go in and see how that policy is being implemented, because I'm sure that the government should not appreciate that the work is being done not to the standard that they would be satisfied with.
The argument is the clerk of works argument. I get it. You see, Mr. Speaker, and that is exactly the point. None of us, the honourable gentleman I think included, and none of the other opposite alongside him, or the other lady who's not there, none of us are qualified as clerk of works. So we might be able as lay people to say the shower hasn't been fitted in a way that looks even for a layperson to be fitted properly. Or you know, the issue has not been the standing has not been done in a perfect way in keeping with the view of a layperson. But the other gentleman is not just inviting us to do things which are, in my view, inappropriate. He's inviting us to do things that none of us are properly qualified to do. And we're fighting to attempt to attack in a way that is inappropriate. So I think the other lady is as aware of this case as he is of the many other cases that are being dealt with. He would be very pleased to know the speaker. And I wonder whether he does know, but even though I can't ask him a question, I would say that I assume that he's very pleased to know that the amount of jobs waiting are being reduced by a factor of 90-odd%. But there are issues jobs waiting, and the jobs that are waiting are being dealt with and given the appropriate priority that they have. But I think it gives away the nub of this issue in the way that we rightly pose this question by saying that this matter has been historically abandoned. Maybe those who have historically abandoned it are the ones who are responsible, not those who are perfectly fixing it.
Question number 452, the Honourable D.A. Peter on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Further to question 168, question 269, and question 397 of 2018, is the government in a position to update the South on when announcement will be made as to the government's commitment to build homes for rentals? Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, an announcement to this effect was made in my budget speech a few months ago.
Mr. Speaker, there is another question in the order paper that has been posted by Mr. Phillips in relation to the number of people that were on the housing waiting list in 2011, which continue to be in the housing waiting list today. The last time that I posed that question, it was 178. Now, part of the reason is I understood the answer that the Honourable Minister gave at the time for those 178, and we've got to bear in mind that it was a manifesto commitment from the party's opposite that anybody in the housing waiting list and the pre list in 2011 would be housed in 4 years. So we're talking about 7 years, and they hadn't been housed. Part of the explanation the Honourable Lady provided was that we were dealing with many of those were one bedroom flats, and that there is a shortage of one-bedroom flats in the government housing stock. That is a question, and I apologise for the preamble, but I need to place it into context. The question is this. In the government's plan to build new rental homes, can the government give a commitment that it will cater for those people in order to make sure that those people are housed, and that we do not have a shortage in the future of one-bedroom flats? And let me say this as well, in that context, that we're not just simply talking about young people that are on the housing waiting list. We're also talking, for example, people like fathers who may unfortunately be divorced, and they are allocated a one-bedroom flat. And those are the type of people that is what we're talking about, and obviously that creates a lot of hardship for a number of people.
Mr. Speaker, after that extensively long supplementary question, I don't think comply with the rules and particularly standing orders. The answer, Mr. Speaker, is do we aim to house the people on the waiting list? Yes, of course, Mr. Speaker. And my job as Minister for Housing is to go and assess the policy of the housing department, is to look at the demand that we have for housing stock, the shortfall that we have for housing stock, and introduce and implement policies which match and meet the demands of this.
The public has a question, and I'll repeat it in short terms, is the government planning to build one bedroom flat so that the majority of these 178, that was the figure that we gave last time around, are properly housed, and that this problem with scarcity of one bedroom flat does not arise in the future?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe that I have to build one bedroom flat in order to meet the demand for one bedroom flat.
Question number 453, the Honourable Dean of Stephen on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Mr. Speaker, further to question 398 of 2018. Can the government have built this house as to the amount of rent arrears owing as from the 12th of September 2018? Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, this information is currently available on the government website as of month end August 2018.
Question number 454, the Honourable D.A. Peterson on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Further to question 399 and 400 of 2018, can the government confirm that it is now in a position to publish the fire safety review? Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, my answer to questions 399 and 400 of 2018 is this.
Question 455, the Honourable D.A. Peterson on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Further to question 401 of 2018, can the Minister update this house as to how many people are on the housing waiting list by category and by reference to RKD1 to RKD5? Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 456.
Question number 456, the Honourable D.A. Peterson on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Can the government update this house as to how many people who were on the housing waiting list on the 8th of December 2011 remain on the list? Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there are 124 and the breakdown is as follows. 1 RKD 111, 2 RKD 2, 3 RKD 8, 4 RKD 2, 5 RKD 10. Of those in the 2 to 5 RKD category, they have been offered at least one home.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady has chosen to answer two questions in one answer, and it's not clear from this. So, if it's the same answer, is he saying that the only people on the housing waiting list by category and by reference to RKD1 to RKD5 are the people that were on the housing waiting list on the 8th of December 2011? That can't be right.
So, Mr. Speaker, that is not the question. And the question this time, I was the same question on the last occasion, which is referred to in answer to this one, is the question wants to know if those who were on the waiting list on the 8th of December 2011 remain on the waiting list, as we were the question. And I'm glad to say, Mr. Speaker, that the numbers are remarkably reduced.
So, Mr. Speaker, of the figure that she has given me, of the people that she says very reduced, so these are, we're talking about the people that were on the housing waiting list as at the 8th of December 2011, of those
124, the bulk, are waiting for one RKB. Yes, that's the answer. Now, again, I return to the previous questions that I've asked and the answer that the Honourable Lady has given in relation to that. She said, I think what she said, I'm paraphrasing, what she said to this House was, not necessarily when I said, well, in the government's plans to build rental accommodation, is the government planning to cater for an increased number of one RKB, because it does seem to be, there does seem to be a problem with a one RKB. Now, in the light of the fact that there are 124 people that were on the housing waiting list on the 8th of December 2011 waiting for a one RKB, what is it precisely is to do in order to cater for these people? Because it does appear to me, from the numbers, that there is a shortage of one RKB in the world.
So, no, Mr. Speaker, because it seems to have misunderstood. On the 8th of December 2011, there were not 111 people. 111 people are those that remain. Those who were on the wait, the number of people on the one RKB waiting list as of the 8th of December 2011, Mr. Speaker, were 1,046. So, when I said earlier, Mr. Speaker, that it has been reduced considerably, that is what I meant, Mr. Speaker. The pace at which we've been dealing with it, Mr. Speaker, is incredibly fast, and we've been making allocations, and of this, 111 remain. Mr. Speaker, in answer to the previous question in relation to the building of flats for rental, I referred the Honourable Gentleman to the announcement that I had already made in my budget. But because the Honourable Gentleman probably doesn't know or doesn't remember what my announcement was in the budget speech, that is what has given rise to the questions that he is now asking. If the Honourable Member were to refer to my budget speech, then the answer would be clear. What I meant in reply to the previous long-winded supplementary question, Mr. Speaker, was that to be able to provide accommodation for a specific configuration of flat doesn't necessarily always mean that you have to build that sophistication of flat, but can also be dealt with in the way that you manage the allocations of flat and the strategic priorities in the allocation. And by combining the way that you do that together with the announcement that I made in my budget speech, Mr. Speaker, I am sure I am confident and satisfied that we will deal with the greatest housing needs very efficiently indeed.
Mr. Speaker, that answer is not going to, with respect to the minister, be any consolation to all those people that were on the housing waiting list in 2011, in respect of which the government is indeed to bear 2011 manifesto, namely to house those people within 4 years. Now, if there's 111, and I apologize, I thought you said 124, but if there's 111 people who were on the housing waiting list in 2011, waiting for a one-bedroom flat, and continue to wait for a one-bedroom flat, it does appear to me that there is a problem with the allocation, with finding enough one-bedroom flats for those people. Because that is the bulk of the people that remain to be housed, that were on the housing waiting list in 2011. Could you explain the reason why the bulk of the numbers are one RKB numbers?
Mr. House, because the Honourable Gentleman has forgotten the explanations that we gave at the time. This is not something that they're asking us about now. It is something that we volunteered at the time at the end of the last Parliament when we realised that we had been able to comply with our commitment to everyone on the housing waiting list except those on the one RKB list, because the ones who are not on the one RKB list, unless I'm wrong, have had a proposed allocation that I've refused. So, Speaker, the one RKB list is deceptive to a very great extent, not just for the reason that the Honourable Gentleman has indicated, it's very difficult, it is not just the elderly and those that, who might find themselves in the situation of a house of great benefit, who actually don't want a one-bedroom flat, because those who find themselves in the situation of a house of great benefit are on the list for a one-bedroom, but they want or need
a 2 or 3 bedroom because many of them have children and they want to be able to have their children with them and it creates other issues. But in particular, Mr. Speaker, there are a lot of people in that list who are young people who put themselves into this in order to be able to be eligible to purchase accommodation when it becomes available, and the first criteria for purchase of affordable housing is whether you are on the housing readiness. And many of them hold over for legacy reasons. In other words, they have put themselves down on the list at the age when they can, but they are still studying, even now. And all the other reasons why they have not been able to take back the right purchase. And they are not so keen, actually, to have a one-bedroom accommodation provided to them. But I have said before, and I will say again, one of the things that honourable members did well when they were in government, except that we had to repair one of them, because it's only a house, and I think it was a question on the other day later, was to start to provide housing for elderly tenants who needed one-bedroom assisted housing. And that is the best accommodation we can provide for one-bedroom, Mr. Speaker, to use the existing housing stock to then release to many of those on the one-bedroom list properties that are larger because they actually need them because they have children and they are in the process of working through that their children should be with them. So we all understand what the issue is, and we all understand that those people on that 111 number had been on that list since before 2011. And resolving the problem has been harder than any of us expected. For good social demographic reasons, unrelated to making available a one-bedroom property. And I think if we're going to have an informed debate across the floor of the House, that has to be factored into the equation. This isn't just the question of today having 111 one-bedroom properties and that would be fixed. It wouldn't. It's much more complex than that. I think the Honourable Gentleman knows that, or at least with this information will be able to factor that into his determination to how to take this forward in a way that might be complementary to the way that the government is trying to resolve this issue.
Well, can I thank the Chief Minister for that answer, which means we certainly have understood. And indeed, I accept that in relation to, I would expect that in relation to the 111, there would be young people that, setting aside the government's manifesto commitment in 2011, then it might be a priority. But of course, does the government know, and if the government cannot provide the answer to this question, which is necessary in order for us to assess the nature of the problem as well, is then provided as a later day by way of change of correspondence, we're happy with that. But can the government give numbers and drill down into the numbers? In relation to those 111, how many are we talking about for simply young people that have gone on the housing waiting list because they want to buy, or alternatively they can't buy, but young people that may not be a priority in inverted commas compared to others? But then you have the category of cases of people that have come to me in my study. Normally it's men that are divorced, that are having to live in very difficult conditions with mothers or family members who have been waiting for a one-bedroom flat, which again is not adequate for those people, because the policy of the government is exactly the same as the policy of the UAE, and has been in this House, that in Cabinet, in discussions, when I was in government, I personally did not agree with the policy, but nonetheless the policy of the Hughes administration and also of the present government to only give those people one bedroom flat. They only waited for one bedroom flat, even though they didn't have 15 children. And we want to just drill down into the nature and category into which these 111 people fall. If you don't have the information in broad figure numbers, then we're quite happy to write to the Honourable Minister and ask for the information.
Mr. Speaker, it's not a question that I have, but having said that, it's something that, as I said earlier, I'm satisfied we will clear when we build the housing for rental, as I announced in my budget.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid, as I indicated earlier this afternoon, before, we might not be able to continue for very long today, and I imagine to adjourn the House. In fact, the House is going to adjourn a little later than I expected. But before I do, I do need to do a reading of a long title. I said, Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to defend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills.
Those in favour, those against, carried. Now, suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills. A bill for an act to make provisions for the application and divorce of certain provisions of the UK Armed Forces Act 2006, for the application of that act to Royal Gibraltar Regiment, for the exercise in Gibraltar of restrictions, powers and competence by service authorities and courts in certain circumstances, for the creation under Gibraltar law of certain offences relating to the armed forces and for matters connected therewith or incidental thereto, beyond board the Chief Minister.
I have the honour to move a bill for an act to make provision for the application to vote to certain provisions of the UK Armed Forces Act 2006, for the application of that act to the Royal Gibraltar Regiment, for the exercise of vote of restrictions, powers and competences by service authorities and courts in certain circumstances, for the creation and Gibraltar law of certain offences relating to the armed forces, and for matters connected therewith, or incidental thereto, to be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for the application in Gibraltar of certain provisions of the UK Armed Forces Act 2006, for the application of that act to the Royal Gibraltar Regiment, for the exercise in Gibraltar of the restrictions, powers and competences by service authorities and courts in certain circumstances, for the creation under Gibraltar law of certain offences relating to the armed forces, and for matters connected therewith, or incidental thereto, be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, I want to move that the House should now adjourn to Friday, the 18th of March at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sorry, I was in October, but October. Friday, the 18th of March, 2030. Friday, the 18th of October, 2018, Mr. Speaker. I'm so honourable, gentlemen. Friday, the 18th of October. Sorry, Thursday, now we've got this right, Mr. Speaker, for one day. Thursday, the 18th of October at 3:30 in the afternoon. Mr. Speaker, before the House rises, in the context of the statement that I made at the beginning, honourable members will want to see also the statements that have been made by the current President of the Spanish government this afternoon in Salzburg, which I think all honourable members will welcome, given the confirmation of some of the things that I've been saying to the House this afternoon.
I will now adjourn to Thursday, the 18th of October at 3:30 in the afternoon.